Well, thank you very much, Lord Selborne. I'm going to be talking about open data somewhat. For one or two of you in this audience, some of these slides may be a little familiar. I make no apologies for that. I think the case still needs to be made and restated as to why this is an important feature of the modern data environment and why we need to kind of work harder and more diligently to ensure that it stays that way. What you're seeing here is an extraordinary product created over 48 hours by about 4,000 volunteers following the devastating earthquake in Kathmandu in Nepal. Learning from a very similar experience in Haiti some years earlier, where the capital city was destroyed, Port-au-Prince, they had no map of the place. When first responders were going in, there was no detailed map of the city. They crowdsourced effectively a map of the place in about 14 days, using a variety of data sources. People with their GPS systems were uploading literally tracks as they walked the streets. They were using satellite imagery that had been provided from commercial sources, using mapping platforms that were made openly available, and using open standards. And this is essentially a lessons learned a little later. That 14 days, in this case, tens of thousands of kilometers of roads and many thousands of buildings that were destroyed were being marked, mapped, and annotated by 4,000 volunteers, in this case, remotely from the site in 48 hours. And that partly happened because of the availability of open platforms and open data and open participation. And this model works in many contexts, the humanitarian relief, of course, emergency response being a very dramatic example. When the ODI began, we actually launched with a number of stories that showed the benefits. This is one of our early startup companies, Mastodon C, and their work on prescription data from the UK. Quite a well-known story, this. Interesting, though, that which analysed all the prescriptions being made out in the NHS England and determined that for certain classes of drugs, there was way more patented drugs being prescribed. These were statins in this case than seemed required. Actually, there were generic versions of these drugs, much cheaper, that were available. The estimate was around £200 million in 1 year had been identified as potential savings. Some of these drugs went off patent, the licenses ones, the context changes. But the insight about taking data at that scale and understanding the pattern of prescribing really has been an opportunity to change behaviour. And just today you may have heard the news that this kind of information made widely available to a practicing community has dramatically lowered the amount of prescribing of antibiotics that's actually happening in our health system. So data can deliver real insight when made widely and openly available. Here's another one that we were very proud of at the time, and one of our companies we were mentoring and incubating, Open Corporates. And funny old thing, this has just come back again, hasn't it? This is the work of Open Corporates, where they were mapping beneficial ownership. Okay, who owns who in the corporate structures? The demand for transparency in this space being dramatically restated again at the recent anti-corruption conference, not to suggest in the slightest that this kind of map of ownership of Goldman Sachs and its various offshore companies in the Cayman Islands, which is the large mass off to the right-hand side of the United States there, the size of the land mass is proportionate to the amount of kind of business going through there. But everybody's beginning to recognise that these routes of beneficial ownership are hugely helpful. They have many, many utilities, many benefits. And one of the things that it's important to state here is that often open data is seen by some as perhaps a fringe activity for corporate social responsibility or the latest bright idea of a government, or possibly the work of social entrepreneurs or NGOs, but where's the real core return? I think we can see in these examples from humanitarian relief to areas like corporate structure, and this one, another one of our startups at the Open Data Institute, the Transport API, which aggregates large amounts of transport data in the UK to provide an open platform which many others then use to run their services off. This company making good revenue out of services it sells back, where the original sources, many of them open and freely licensed, have been aggregated together and resold out. And in this case, much of its data, for example, for London, comes from Transport for London's open data feeds, has really changed the game in the sorts of applications we now routinely use, not just from Transport API, but many other companies who use this data to provide us with a much more exquisite experience of getting around this place, creating economic value, social value, and a whole range of other benefits. So I don't think that open data is finished business, and it's not just about protesting a grand vision where every kind of data is open, as I will come back to discuss. We recognised that the whole spectrum of data types is complex, but we were working explicitly in those early years to release data that had been collected by governments, to republish it out, collected at taxpayers' expense, to republish it out, and particularly where it didn't compromise, there wasn't an issue of personal identificatory information, the benefits that could accrue. And that argument has been expanded on under successive governments to a position now where we're talking about trying to identify data as an infrastructure, as a piece of national infrastructure, the operation of which and the curation and production of which is as valuable as our roads and our power grids. Now, in the UK, we begin to see this kind of discourse and dialogue happening. And I'll give you three examples there where we now have high quality open data published that becomes a core reference for how other pieces of business gets transacted in the UK. There's the Ordnance Survey, administrative data on the top left-hand corner there, a whole set of structured data around how the UK is administratively organised, postcodes, upwards, parishes, voting boundaries, and so on, such that we can now link events to administrative geography in the country, freely, openly licensed. Or the data from the Land Registry on historic prices for property transactions, a whole range of new open data now that is available for analysis and reuse. Or indeed Companies House, who used to sell their data but now publish it as an open registry of all the legally constituted companies in the country, in itself hugely valuable because there is a unique reference which many, many other departments of government can use and reference. And the thought here is that these items are an essential piece of our infrastructure. And why shouldn't governments think about providing high-quality infrastructure or in concert with the private providers providing high-quality infrastructure, which is available for all to use with the widest possible utility? And the thought is, whether it's contracts or energy, spending or supplies to government, geography, properties, companies, timetables, fares, performance of our railways, this starts to form the fabric, if you like, the skeleton for a set of reference data about how this country works and runs. And that a considerable amount of this should be available as open data. And the challenge, I think, for going forward is to understand, well, just how much of this data infrastructure, do we need? What currently exists? And can we seriously expect that it's there to be picked up and reused? I think a challenge for government is that infrastructures typically need to be invested in, and that rather than selling off and privatising our registers, and that I should say that in the consultations that are happening now, that is not in view, but the danger should not be that these data registers find themselves in private ownership, that they are a public good. Nevertheless, the organisations supporting and running those could end up in the private space, no doubt. But that the wider use of this public infrastructure is to be supported and developed by any modern nation state. And the question that follows on from this, what parts of our data infrastructure do we need to build and design that we don't currently have? Nobody expects the sum total of our existing data to be sufficient for all the demands we might make in the future. How do we begin to think about providing a backbone of particular registers and data assets that comprise this infrastructure. The world is moving to a set of collected assets, many of which are licensed openly. One of the most interesting ones is the distillation of all of Wikipedia as a set of data, as a set of facts about those events and people and personages and places that Wikipedia talks about. And off that, many other data sets link and aggregate. And within that connected open data cloud, government data is forming an increasingly important part. And the point about this is that that kind of structure is being used not just by governments, but also by commercial entities. So in Google Search now, when we put in a search term and get this structured information on the right, that information in the knowledge panel using Google's knowledge graph format, much of that has been harvested from open resources on the web. Interestingly, harvested and often improved, and one would ask, you know, well, should that be put back into the openly accessible domain? And there's all sorts of interesting questions as you improve and enhance data that's in the public domain, what should happen to it? But nevertheless, clear evidence here and in many other places of data at scale, at web scale, being improved and enhanced and used in a whole range of purposes. Now, data does not come in just an open format. We've been working quite hard at the ODI to help develop language and definitional frameworks to help policymakers, to help companies, to help organizations navigate their way through this blizzard of interest around the data world, around the so-called data ecosystem. And we recognize that data will come in different forms and shapes and strains. The open data I've been talking about, the bus timetables, the kind of information about where the hospitals are and what we spend in our various government departments, openly available to anyone to access. We understand that there will be more general public access, which will have constraints, licenses that limits its use. Or indeed, we would want to have group-based access that you authenticate to, that is shared between groups of interested parties. And of course, all the way through that to various forms of highly sensitive data, which will stay within very well-controlled domains. And so whether it's about the person, whether it's commercial data or government data, whether it's small, medium or big, the issue of where our data falls in this spectrum is material, because your strategy cannot just exist in a world where you imagine there's just one kind of data to pay attention to. And that's the challenge for us, I think, as policymakers, as regulators, to understand that no one size fits all. One thing we would say, actually, in all of this space, is there is huge utility in requiring and asking that people in the business of building and defining and collecting and specifying and analysing data might use open standards to do that, because in the future that allows them to shift the boundary of use in that spectrum. Even if it's private to start with or shared in some form, if you're using open standards, that will allow for interoperability in a way that other proprietorial formats do not support. Okay, and just to finish here, a huge challenge on that spectrum is the whole world of personal data. We understand that. And we are all understanding of the fact that this world presents challenges. And it's particularly interesting to look at where much of the competition currently is. And yes, it's around health data, but it's as much around this world, the world of well-being or fitness data. The fact that routinely we are now being offered devices and methods by which large amounts of our daily pattern of life is collected and dispatched and structured by various companies and third parties. And the question we naturally ask is, who has rights and access to that information? And what are the responsibilities that come with that? And there is, of course, much debate about how we settle that. All I would suggest is that in all of this, the citizen or the consumer has to have a sense, at least, if not of ownership, of some level of empowerment, perhaps in some case ownership, but certainly the idea that in a world where we are generating large amounts of data from our activities, from our patterns, that there is simply an asymmetry currently between the ability of an individual to have any sense of material control. And although there'll be export functions in some of these apps, or you can get a report back in PDF or some useless format, you very seldom get the data in a format that another third party can consume and use to connect this data ecosystem together. So in the world of personal data, we will see an interesting, I think, set of debates. We're beginning to see it, not always, I would suggest, phrased in the right way. The danger is regulation that stops innovation happening. I'd much rather see a move to situations where we promote innovation so that individuals become much more empowered by the data that governments and companies collect and hold about them in the services that they provide. And a final point, perhaps, is to reflect on what we know from this. I was involved with a group of other people putting together this report just last year on the privacy bridges. This was actually the particular problem that existed between the EU and US around the challenges following post-Snowden and so on, what we were going to do to secure the effective flow of information and give some support to both companies and individuals and governments to still innovate around the data space that we're seeing around us. So I think it's important. This is actually a very practical and pragmatic set of suggestions in that report, and I'd recommend it. And lest we think that the future is always, you know, in a certain sense, deeply unknowable, there are sometimes moments when you look at the existing status quo and wonder if it must be so. At the moment, we live in a world which is essentially platform-centric, with extraordinarily powerful and successful companies offering very powerful services back to us, often as central information controllers. Now, for some people, this is seen as a huge benefit. For other people, there is nervousness. It isn't necessarily the case that this settlement will always be as is. And of course, there are a bunch of efforts underway in various labs, up and down and around the world, to re-decentralize these sorts of platforms. So whenever we think there's a problem to be solved with an existing architectural settlement, it ain't necessarily going to stay that way. So imagine a world in which we had people who owned, in a more substantial sense, their data assets. Well, then we'd have a different set of challenges. For example, they become their own data controller. Do we have any idea what that world would look like? And I think one of the challenges for us as a community is to imagine where innovation just doesn't simply have to address the problems of today, but might face new challenges in the future. Thank you very much. Thank you.